The following is for your ears only. Now in our 31st year, I'm David Alpern.
I'm Catherine Herzog, and we have newsmakers, experts, and top reporters to bring you these stories.
The arguments on Arizona, early readings on Supreme Court consideration of a tough state law on illegal immigrants.
The campaign on campus, but U.S. student loan policy is only one face of pre-convention presidential competition, now down to just Romney and Obama.
The world of G-Zero, how political and economic constraints cripple international leadership.
Of Bombs, Bones, and Bears, a veteran TV producer-director talks about his work on the anti-terror series 24, forensic drama Bones, and now a line of children's books.
Loud and Proud, the organization Live Out Loud provides reassurance and role models for teens struggling with different sexual orientation.
Plus notable quotes from last week's news.
All that and more for your ears only, a production of GateWave.org, the nonprofit radio reading service for those with disabilities. For your ears only, for the week of April 29th, I'm David Alpern.
I'm Catherine Herzog.
The principal provision of the Arizona law that was discussed today really just puts the federal officials in the position to know who they have in the country and then decide for themselves what to do as a matter of federal law.
It profiles people. If you have brown skin in my state, you're going to be asked to prove your citizenship.
Two views of Arizona's controversial Show Your Papers legal response to illegal immigration. First, former U.S. Solicitor General Paul Clement, straight from arguing for the state before the U.S. Supreme Court last week. Then Arizona's former Democratic Senator Dennis DeConcini, after testifying about the law before the Senate Judiciary Committee, although the issue of profiling was specifically not under consideration by the high court.
Ironically, the oral arguments took place just as official reports noted a significant fall off in the human tide coming across the Mexican border and an increased reverse flow linked both to stepped up enforcement and falling employment prospects. To discuss the issues, the court's response to oral arguments, and the implications of a decision either way, we have Jennifer Chang Newell, staff attorney at the Immigrants' Rights Project of the American Civil Liberties Union and author of the ACLU's amicus brief to the Supreme Court. Welcome to our program.
Hi. Thanks for having me, Catherine.
Why was racial profiling off the table for the purposes of last week's proceedings?
Well, the Arizona law does raise serious concerns that police officers are going to stop people based on the color of their skin, based on whether they look or sound foreign. But the legal question of racial profiling, which is essentially whether the law violates our Constitution's equal protection guarantee, was not raised in the federal government's litigation against the Arizona law and therefore was not in front of the court. The ACLU's lawsuit against SB 1070 does raise an equal protection claim, and that issue will be in front of the district court in our case. It's also important to know that there are other legal claims against the Arizona law that were not before the court, but that are also part of other litigation, such as the ACLU's lawsuit, including whether the law violates the Fourth Amendment.
What were the specific issues the judges were willing to consider last week?
Well, the court was being asked and is being asked to consider whether we should have a patchwork of 50 different immigration laws in 50 different states or whether we should have only one consistent immigration law for the whole country. Put another way, the court is really deciding whether Arizona overstepped its state power by trying to act in the immigration area, which has always been one of national importance and exclusive federal supremacy.
And what was the position of your ACLU amicus brief on those issues?
Our brief says that Arizona has exceeded its limited state powers in the immigration area. Under the federal immigration laws, states can only participate in immigration enforcement in certain limited circumstances, and those are spelled out in the immigration statutes. They can only participate where, you know, in the limited circumstances that the immigration laws say they can, and with the federal government in the driver's seat. The state's limited power doesn't include the power to unilaterally arrest and detain people based on immigration status, which is what Arizona is trying to do. States don't have any inherent power to act in the immigration area because, as the Supreme Court has long recognized, immigration is an area with a special need for uniformity and federal supremacy.
Many accounts of Wednesday's Arizona argument mentioned the awkward moment when Justice Sonia Sotomayor, an Obama appointee, told Obama Solicitor General Donald Verrilli that his argument was, quote, not selling very well. Why don't you try to come up with something else? Overall, how do you read the reports of the court's questions and reactions?
Well, Justice Sotomayor's comment was directed at a specific argument that the Solicitor General was making as opposed to his argument as a whole. In any event, the justices did seem very skeptical about the validity of the two provisions of SB 1070 that create state law penalties for failure to carry alien registration papers and for working without federal permission. In addition, several justices expressed serious civil liberties concerns that the Show Me Your Papers provision would cause people to be detained for longer than they otherwise would. It came through in court that there's really no easy way for a citizen who happens not to be carrying their ID with them to avoid being detained for an hour or more on the side of the road while an officer demands that they prove their right to live here. And although Paul Clement argued that it doesn't take more than 11 minutes to verify immigration status with the government, the federal government, the Solicitor General made clear that, in fact, the average wait time is 70 minutes for the federal government to confirm someone's immigration status. And what that means is that U.S. citizens, green card holders, asylum seekers, domestic violence survivors could all be detained for over an hour while their status is being ascertained. You know, at the end of the day, we're hopeful, given that the court expressed a lot of skepticism about the two criminal provisions, and Arizona was really trying to read its law more narrowly as a way to save it. But we think it can't be saved.
Another justice, Elena Kagan, has recused herself following work on this issue as Obama's previous Solicitor General. What happens if that leads to a 4-4 tie in the current case?
A 4-4 split would mean that Arizona would lose this case because the decision below, which held that these four provisions of SB 1070 were unconstitutional, would be affirmed. And in that event, there would be no controlling opinion issued by the Supreme Court.
If I understand you correctly, even if the court should decide in favor of the Arizona law on these jurisdictional grounds, there will be a second opportunity to argue against it on the grounds of racial profiling and other issues.
Well, definitely other parties can always bring an equal protection racial profiling claim against the Arizona law. And as I mentioned, the ACLU lawsuit includes that claim. I think the possibility you're referring to is that the court might say this is a facial challenge, the law hasn't gone into effect yet, so there might be problems that could arise if the law goes forward that could make the law legally invalid. Is that what you're referring to?
That was part of it, but mentioning these other suits that are also working their way up through the lower courts is something to keep in mind. There's also the question of whether the Arizona law criminalizes religious freedom and humanitarian activity, the kind of help to immigrants that many churches and American citizens of faith give to immigrants based on need and not on legal status. Talk about that.
Sure. The Arizona law makes it a separate state crime to transport or harbor undocumented immigrants, and religious and humanitarian groups have serious concerns that that provision could be used to prosecute Good Samaritans. The courts, there have been several other states, in addition to Arizona, that have passed this type of law prohibiting harboring and making it a state crime to harbor or transport. And in every single case, I believe the courts have struck down that provision as being preempted by federal law. That issue is not before the Supreme Court.
Of course, your concern is the law and not politics. But what does your work with legal immigrant and religious groups suggest would be the impact on the votes of their constituents if the administration wins this legal battle or loses?
I'm not a political commentator, and I always hate to speculate. If the court upholds the Arizona law in this case, it could have the effect of really galvanizing immigrant groups to support political candidates and political parties that have more of a pro-immigrant stance. And I imagine that would certainly mean that voters who are concerned about immigrants' rights issues might be more inclined to vote with their feet and move towards the Democrats.
Jennifer Chang Newell is a staff attorney at the Immigrants' Rights Project of the American Civil Liberties Union and author of the ACLU's amicus brief to the Supreme Court.
Quote from the news, aura, charisma? I don't think so. That was international media mogul Rupert Murdoch playing himself down before a British commission investigating phone hacking and other alleged improprieties at his English media properties. Murdoch blamed top aides for keeping him in the dark and denied using his media power to win favor from top British politicians.
Next, more on politics, the presidential campaign on campus and beyond. For your ears only. We have more for your ears only. I'm Catherine Herzog.
I'm David Alpern with this quote from the news. For something to get this out of control, it has to be a cultural blueprint. That was South Carolina's Republican Senator Lindsey Graham doubting that the Secret Service prostitution problem was limited to the recent scandal in Colombia. And indeed, the service last week began investigating a new charge that agents hired strippers and prostitutes in El Salvador as well when the president visited last year. Now this.
Tonight is the start of a new campaign to unite every American who knows in their heart that we can do better. The last few years have been the best that Barack Obama can do, but it's not the best America can do.
This is the economy. This is about your job security. This is about your future. If you do well, the economy does well. This is about the economy.
After winning five more primaries in a single day last week, Mitt Romney could turn his fire more fully than ever on President Obama, to the extent that at least some Republican leaders urged him to say more about what and how he would do different. Obama, meanwhile, took criticism for campus visits that stoked his appeal to young voters. But it was apparently effective enough to swing Romney and congressional Republicans behind his pitch to continue low rates on federal college loans, albeit with predictable partisan division over funding.
Partisan division over Arizona-style state laws on illegal immigration and reauthorizing the Federal Violence Against Women Act also focused on the importance of Latino and female voters. One average of national polls gave Obama a 4-point lead over Romney, with greater and lesser margins in five swing states. 2 points in Virginia, Florida, and Arizona, 5 points in Ohio, 14 in New Mexico. To consider all these political developments and more for Your Ears Only, we're joined again by GOP consultant and Reagan biographer Craig Shirley. His new book is December 1941, 31 Days That Changed America and Saved the World, from Thomas Nelson Publishers. Welcome back to the program.
Thank you, Catherine and David.
We mentioned Romney seconding the call to keep student loan rates at their current reduced level, but congressional Republicans are moving to take the money from a preventive care fund under Obamacare. Is that an illustration of the story we read earlier last week about GOP leaders on the Hill thinking they, not Romney, should be setting the party's agenda?
Well, I think what it does illustrate is the division of the Republican Party and what it's going to campaign on, and in fact, what it does stand for. I think most Americans regard this as more Washington game playing that has really very little impact on their daily lives. And it adds to the sense of cynicism and disgust with Washington.
Well, some Democrats say raiding that preventative care fund is another example of the so-called war against women, though Obama himself targeted that fund in earlier tax negotiations. Was that a tactical GOP error?
Now, Catherine, I think again it's just an example of the game plan that's going on by both parties. No doubt that there's a gender gap in both parties that has gone back to the 1980s. I remember it was discovered right after the 1980 election when women in greater numbers supported Jimmy Carter than Ronald Reagan, but conversely, men in greater numbers supported Reagan over Carter, and we've seen that continue pretty much unabated for the last 30 years. Although in the 2010 elections, women, like men, voted for Republican congressional candidates. So I think it's up to the Republicans to create a more compelling message for women than the Democratic Party. And right now, they're not doing it.
We also read that some GOP leaders think Romney should scale down anti-Obama rhetoric and ramp up talk about his specific alternatives. But conventional wisdom says Obama does better in an election about alternatives than one that's a referendum on him alone. What's your view?
I think that a party that runs as simply a group of beginners is only half of a party. And that's been the problem with the Republican Party ever since the election of President Obama. It's always been simply opposition to Obama's policies, but never offering their own creative solutions. That was so what was so unique about the campaign of 1980 was that when Governor Reagan was running, it wasn't just an anti-Carter message. It was a message about the practical applications of a conservative philosophy and how it benefited the American people. So far, the Romney campaign in the primaries ran basically a campaign to destroy his opponents, whether it was Rick Perry or Newt Gingrich or Rick Santorum or whoever popped up in the polls. But I think it's a mistake to go to the nomination in Tampa Bay with representing only half of the argument against President Obama.
Romney also seemed a bit more sympathetic to the illegal immigrant issue, saying he'd consider legislation being developed by Florida's Republican Senator Mark Rubio. How do you think that will play out?
Well, you know, Catherine, it's fascinating is how this issue has really faded. I think the last national poll that asked Americans to rank what was most on their minds had 3% cited illegal immigration, as opposed to in 2006 when it was right up there at the top. And, of course, with the new reports coming out from, I think it came out from Pew Research, that said more Mexicans are leaving the United States and going back to Mexico than are coming from Mexico into the United States is somewhat rendering it a moot issue. But there's no doubt both sides are wrong. One is, has an image of anti-immigration, build a wall, deport 12 million people, and that's simply impractical. The other side is to allow illegals to stay here without any taxes or penalty or joining the American culture and society, and that is equally wrong. What has got to come up with the humane but also tough policy that accepts illegals without creating a gateway for new illegals to see it as a green light to come in without paying any penalty or joining American society and culture.
Well, you say it's lost salience to the general electorate, but I wonder what impact you see on the Latino vote itself from a Supreme Court decision, say, on Arizona's illegal immigrant law. Could a loss in the court anger and energize that growing demographic?
I don't know. You know, is that if you ask Latinos and other recent immigrants who have come here legally, they have the same attitudes as natural-born Americans about illegal immigration. So I'm not sure.
Going back to Rubio, how do you see his prospects as a Romney running mate?
I noticed his speech this week, Catherine. And it almost seemed like he was somewhat of an audition for vice president. If the motivation is that he would produce a unified convention, then he's qualified to be vice president and to become president should that become necessary, then he's in the running. If it's simply to pander to a certain constituency, then that by definition that should rule him out.
Romney was clearly the big winner in the Republican nominating race, and Rick Santorum also emerged with greater stature. Not so Rick Perry, Michelle Bachmann, Herman Cain, John Huntsman, and especially Newt Gingrich, about whom you're working on a biography. Where do you think his reputation and political prospects stand at this point?
David, I think we'd all be kidding ourselves if we didn't acknowledge that Gingrich was hurt in this process. On the other hand, when tempers have cooled and we look at from the arc of history and we look at the impact that he had and probably will beyond this on national politics, when we think of Henry Clay, we don't think of his two failed presidential campaigns. You think of the compromise of 1820, the compromise of 1850, the War Hawks, his concern about the annexation of Texas, one of the triumvirate of great congressional leaders, along with John Calhoun and Daniel Webster. So you don't think of them just in terms of one presidential campaign. You think of them in the totality of their careers.
GOP consultant and Reagan biographer Craig Shirley. His new book is December 1941, 31 Days That Changed America and Saved the World from Thomas Nelson Publishers.
Quote from the news, reckless. That's how Federal Reserve Chairman Ben Bernanke described calls for more economic stimulus and accompanying inflation that would produce only modest job growth. And this, disappointing. That was PBS President Paula Kerger on a major cut in funding from the National Endowment for the Arts, which instead gave significant new grants for gaming, mobile, and web-based projects.
Next, welcome to the world of G-Zero, for your ears only.
We have more for Your Ears Only. I'm David Alpern.
I'm Catherine Herzog with this news quote. If they were going to pull the trigger, they had to do it today. That was Pakistani newspaper columnist Cyril Almeida on the country's Supreme Court conviction of Prime Minister Yousaf Raza Gilani on contempt charges for not seeking the reinstatement of an international court case against President Asif Ali Zardari, but then releasing him within minutes. More battles between the court and government are expected, and talks between Islamabad and Washington broke down. Now this.
The G-Zero is the reality of the present world order. It's not that the United States is doing the kind of lifting it has historically. It doesn't have the will, and it has less of the capabilities. But nobody else is going to step up and play that role. That is true whether you look at Europe and the European crisis, whether you look at Syria and the ability and willingness to in any way try to help resolve that.
Back in February, Eurasia Group President Ian Bremmer returned from the annual economic summit in Davos, Switzerland, and talked on this show about his observation of a new G0 world in which limits on resources and political consensus in so many countries undermine international leadership on a host of global issues. Now Bremmer has expanded that concept in a new book titled Every Nation for Itself, Winners and Losers in a G0 World, from Portfolio Publishers.
The continuing challenges to peace from Syria, Iran, and North Korea, among others, and the resurgent economic problems in Great Britain, the Eurozone, and the U.S. all underscore the serious implications for Americans. And to consider all of that for Your Ears Only, Ian Bremmer joins us again now. Welcome back to the program.
Delighted to be with you guys.
You chuckle about all the debate over whether the United States is in decline when so many other factors led to the new G0 world of no international leadership. Name some of the most important and the single shock that was what you see as the chief catalyst.
No, that's right. I mean, everyone's talking about the decline of the U.S., but I mean, we all know that whether or not the U.S. is in decline, we're not going to lead a new deal on global climate. We're not going to bail out Europe. Frankly, from my perspective, we're not going to bomb Iran. And so it's not whether or not the U.S. is in decline that's the issue. And, of course, the 2008 financial crisis was the birth of the G0. That was really what created this environment where there is no global leadership. But it's been coming for a long time because the underlying balance of power has shifted from the U.S. towards China, from the developed towards the developing world, and from the debtor states towards the creditor states. And as that happened, I mean, there have been plenty of shocks, 9/11, the collapse of the Soviet Union, but you needed one that was big enough that was really going to collapse the old world system, and that was the 2008 financial crisis.
You see the international dynamic following this pattern of creative destruction that marks so many domestic business cycles. Talk a bit about that.
Well, I think this is geopolitical creative destruction. I mean, in business cycles, of course, if you are, if you're, let's say, an independent bookseller and Barnes & Noble comes along, you either adapt or you die. And then, of course, Amazon comes along and Barnes & Noble adapts or it dies. It happens constantly, and that's the way that businesses, sort of fail and succeed. In the geopolitical environment, that doesn't happen often. The last time it happened was World War II, when coming out of the war, the United States was the only country left standing, and the U.S. basically created a world order from scratch, building up not only its allies in Europe, but even its vanquished former enemy in Japan. We've had a U.S.-led global order now for the better part of 70 years, and now we don't. And we're experiencing creative destruction in the geopolitical environment where a new order will have to emerge. That new order is not the G0. The G0 is an interregnum. It is the process of creative destruction. Something will come after, but we don't know what it is yet.
Your new book finds both good news and bad from the world of G0. The bad is obvious, as the current international order seems hard-pressed to deal with continuing violence in Syria, continuing nuclear development by North Korea and Iran, continuing debt and capital crises in Europe, last week especially in Spain, France, Great Britain. What's the good news?
Well, yeah, that's a pretty big list, but there is good news. The first piece of good news is that in an environment where the U.S. isn't providing leadership, that's a problem for the U.S. It's a much bigger problem for everyone else. They used to say, you've got two guys and there's a bear that's going to chase them, and you don't have to outrun the bear. You just have to outrun the other guy, right? That's the United States perspective. The U.S. is going to be much more attractive as not only a destination for investment, but also in terms of political support and its leadership from allies, because there'll be so much more volatility in the world. It's a very large and it's a very resilient economy. But the other good news is that there are many countries out there and companies out there that are resilient and have the capacity to adapt to very different world orders. And those are countries and companies that will do very well. And in the case of countries, I call these pivot states. And they're countries that basically can choose multiple partners very easily. Mexico can't do that, but Canada can, and Turkey can, and Singapore can, and Indonesia can, Brazil can. There are many countries around the world that actually will perform quite well in a G0 environment.
How do you see the rise of China, but now a slowing of its economic growth, affecting the G0 world?
How do you say G1 in Mandarin?
Well, I think in Mandarin, you say that the G1 doesn't exist and will never exist. The Chinese have no desire to take that level of responsibility internationally, either by themselves or in conjunction with the United States. And so, you know, China will become the world's largest economy. There are a lot of people that think it'll happen sooner. Some think it'll happen later. But one thing we know is that when it becomes the world's largest economy, it will still be a very poor nation, and it will be overwhelmingly focused on its own domestic affairs. And I think we seriously underappreciate as Americans just how different the world will be when the largest economy and in some ways the largest putative political player is a developing and authoritarian state. That's not a G1 environment at all.
Eurasia Group founder and president Ian Bremmer. His new book is Every Nation for Itself, Winners and Losers in a G0 World, from Portfolio Publishers.
Quote from the news, leaders know you have to watch your back because you never know who will put a knife in it. That was China expert Roderick McFarquhar on news that rising Communist Party official Bo Xilai, before his recent ouster in connection with suspected corruption and murder, had wiretapped China's top leader and other fellow officials. And this, the impact could be huge. That was former Justice Department prosecutor Paul Pelletier on the recent charges of bribery by Walmart to boost its presence in Mexico, likely causing U.S. companies to be much more vigilant in their overseas operations.
Next, from bullets and bombs to bones and now bears, for your ears only. We have more for your ears only. I'm Catherine Herzog.
I'm David Alpern with this news quote. Every child deserves a fifth birthday. That's the name of the anti-malaria campaign launched last week by the U.S. Agency for International Development, which also reported helping cut malaria cases in half in over 40 countries, reducing childhood malarial deaths by 200,000 and significantly cutting what had been a $12 billion a year loss in economic productivity. Now this.
I'm with an informant that I used to run his intel on an assassination attempt on President Hassan.
If President Hassan is killed, this peace process dies with him.
This man is a once-in-a-lifetime leader.
Officer, my name is Jack Bauer. I'm transporting this man on behalf of CTU.
He's going down now.
I was lecturing on defleshing techniques at American University.
Methods which preserve the bone perfectly require patience.
You might think it a long, unlikely path from the bombs and bullets of Fox Television's anti-terrorism show 24 and the forensic romance of its Bones series to children's books about cute bears, whose theme from the internet we also just heard. But it comes naturally to Ian Toynton, British-born producer and director on both those TV shows, and now author of 3 Hooligan Bears books. And to talk about all of them for your ears only, Ian Toynton joins us now. Welcome to our show.
Thank you very much.
You had great success with 24 and Bones. How did you first get involved with broadcasting?
I joined the BBC many years ago and then moved into a company called Euston Films, which was an offshoot of one of the television stations in England. And then was fortunate enough to work with them for over a period of about 10 years and did several miniseries for them as well.
How did you get to Fox Television and the anti-terrorism 24 series?
I'd worked on several shows, and I assume and will hope that just the work that I'd done had attracted an interest in me as a director. And 24 was in its infancy, and it was such a wonderful show. I was delighted to be part of it.
What was the hardest part of working on 24? There was actually some criticism about the tough tactics the show was taking and that it was pushing American viewers and their leaders into more confrontational foreign policies.
It was strange because I worked on the very early early seasons. I was involved with season 2 and season 3, so I don't... That criticism was something that sort of was of the later season. So fortunately, I sidestepped that one.
Let's shift to Bones, whose creator, forensic anthropologist and novelist Kathy Reichs, we had on this show 2 years ago. Was it more difficult working with a real expert whose novels were actually the basis of the show?
It was a slightly different approach because although Kathy was the creator of the books, the TV series was created by Hard Hansen, who's a brilliant showrunner. And so it had a slightly different slant. And because when you're dealing with forensic drama on television, you have to be quite careful of what you can actually show. Now, on Bones, we do try and push the envelope as much as possible, but it's not a documentary, so certain things will always have a television drama approach rather than the actual approach.
It seems to me when I first watched that show, it was almost all about the science, with the limits that you've just mentioned. Just a hint of sexual tension between the lady doc and the cop. Now that balance has been reversed. It seems as much a romance as a drama. Were you involved with that shift, or was it ordained? Was it inevitable, given the realities of TV today?
I wouldn't say it was inevitable. I certainly think because the chemistry between the two lead actors is so good and because they get on so well that it was a natural progression within the shows. It is the core of the show now, and I don't know that it probably wasn't right from the beginning. It just became more apparent as we moved in through the seasons.
Let's switch now from the little screen to those little bears of yours, the Hooligan Bear books. Though we've read you were writing children's stories as far back as your days in Britain. Tell us about those early efforts and what inspired them.
I've always had an interest, whether it was Disney or Winnie the Pooh or the Muppets. I've always had an enormous interest in animation and stop-frame animation. And it seemed for me when I was working in England, it seemed a natural progression to try and go into children's stories, which I wrote several short stories, primarily for myself. But in the end, I realized there might be a market. I made a stop frame animation pilot, which didn't actually go. But the stories, and in fact the stories for Hooligan Bear, have been in my mind for many years. I'd never really found the vehicle to manage to get them into the public consciousness. So when one day I was, it's in a way it's a lovely story. I was sitting with my wife on the sofa watching a TV show, and my dog, who's a rescue dog, jumped onto the sofa and she said he looks like a little bear, which in fact he does. And I had responded that there's a certain part of a hooligan in him. And suddenly the name Hooligan Bear leapt into my mind. And the rest just flowed. So I was very fortunate, really.
We think of hooligans as troublemakers. What's the larger message you hope kids will take from these bears of yours and their adventures?
Well, it's very important to me that the word hooligan is not associated with the British term. What I did initially was I wanted to write a series of adventure books. But what happened pretty soon after I started writing them, I realized that actually the stories were swinging over to obviously including adventure, but the fact that there was caring and understanding and compassion in the stories was becoming more and more important. And I think it is, for me, it's the cornerstone of the series that these bears look after one another and they care for one another. And I think that's something that is so important today, that children understand that. It's we live in quite a cold world at times. And if people do take that time to look after one another, and if children are educated to care for one another, I mean, they are. Children are the most important thing we have, and if we look after their education and their health, they are our future.
Ian Toyton was a producer, a director on the Fox TV series 24 and Bones, now author of 3 Hooligan Bears books.
For every bear that ever there was will gather there for certain, because today's the day the teddy bears have their picnic.
Next, Loud and Proud, for your ears only.
We'll be right back.
We're back for Your Ears Only. I'm David Alpern.
I'm Catherine Herzog with this news quote, "I'm very bullish on women." That was U.S. Marine Corps General James Amos on admitting female Marines to the Infantry Officer School at Quantico, Virginia, and some ground combat battalions for the first time. Now this.
Welcome, bienvenue, welcome. Fremda, étranger, stranger. Glücklich zu sehen, je suis enchanté. Happy to see you! Bleibe, reste, stay!
High school is hardly the welcoming cabaret that Alan Cumming sang about on Broadway, especially for the strangers, gay, lesbian, and transgender teens. But Cummings this week will be awarded for his work providing reassurance and a role model for just such kids by a New York group called Live Out Loud.
There will also be some awards for some LGBT kids themselves for moving past possible victimhood, private shame, public bullying, to leadership roles among their peers. To talk more about the problems of LGBT youth and the work of Live Out Loud, for Your Ears Only, we have the group's founder and executive director, Leo Preziosi Jr. Welcome to the program.
Thank you. I'm really happy to be here.
Well, tell us how you came to create Live Out Loud and why.
Well, in 2000, I came across an article about two young teenage boys, both gay, both struggling with their identity, and very sadly, very unfortunate, both were bullied. And like a lot of, too many kids today, both committed suicide. And the article had great impact on me. And I knew I needed to be in action around this younger generation. I knew I needed to step up. I went through the same thing when I was a kid. And I know what that feeling was like. I know the fear on a daily basis. And I thought, oh, I mean, this has got to stop. This has got to stop. And that's what was the impetus for starting Live Out Loud.
You're honoring actor Alan Cummings at your gala this year. Tell us about his involvement in helping the LGBT community.
It's interesting, just listening to the song he sang, I look at Alan and there's such freedom. He stands for freedom about expressing oneself. And he's an enormous support, not only to our organization, but to many, many organizations in the LGBT community. And we're fortunate to have his voice with us for probably the last 9 years. And in 2008, Alan stepped up to the plate when we were producing. We teamed up with Showtime and we produced a public service announcement with regards to the Homecoming Project, where we invite members of the gay community to go back to their hometown high school to share their stories with today's gay youth. And he came up and he did this incredible PSA, and he's just, you know, an incredible voice. And he's really there's that quote by Oscar Wilde. What's the name of that quote? You know, you are your own creation. And when I look at someone like Alan, he's definitely his own creation. And that's what we want to get through to this younger generation of LGBT youth.
You're also awarding five different teens $5,000 scholarships at the annual gala. Tell us about some of these kids and the work for which they're being recognized.
The most exciting thing about my job is we get to interview these incredible high school seniors who are having such an impact on their communities and their high schools. And they're really just, their contributions are amazing. And there's one gentleman who will be winning the award, John Otto III, and he actually testified in the state Senate and Assembly for marriage equality. There's a young lady, Cassidy Madison, who is the president of her Gay Straight Alliance Club and has led rallies in her high school. And it's just a voice in her community and in her high school that kids go to all the time and really share their issues. They feel more safe with her, talking to her, than they do with teachers and counselors. And when I hear these stories, I thought, oh my goodness, at such a young age, you know, you're really stepping up to the plate and making a difference. And that's exciting. And that's why we get to honor them and celebrate their contributions. And that's exciting.
And to go back to the Homecoming Project, it's not just celebrities like Alan Cumming and B.D. Wong who's hosting your gala this week, but you're getting ordinary folks who are in the LGBT community to come back and do their part.
Yeah, you know, it's mostly ordinary folks. We had one high-profile person go back, and that was Academy Award winner Lance Black. And that was amazing. We did a wonderful short documentary that you can actually see on our website at liveoutloud.info. But we, you know, everyone, we have college students going back. We have teachers going back. We have executives going back. And they're going back all over the country. We've sent people back to Utah and Kentucky and Michigan and Florida. And it's really, really important because for us, we really want to, you know, have the participants of the Homecoming Project say to the students, listen, I sat exactly where you're sitting. I know this community. I know the language they speak. But this is what I created. This is the struggles that I've got past. And these are my successes. We really want them to share their personal stories and hopefully continue the relationship with the school and with the Gay Straight Alliance.
Leo Preziosi Jr. is the founder and executive director of Live Out Loud, which holds its annual gala April 30th at the Times Center in Manhattan, honoring actor Alan Cummings.
And this has been For Your Ears Only. For Your Ears Only, On Air is online at iTunes, YouTube, and FeedBurner.com. To pledge a much-needed tax-deductible donation, please email davideearsonly@gmail.com.
This broadcast was engineered by Chad Daly at Hanger Studio. With intern Daniela Quintanilla, I'm Catherine Herzog.
I'm David Alpern. We're supported by nonprofit Gatewave.org Radio Reading Service, the Nathan Cummings Foundation, the Council on Hemispheric Affairs, and award-winning ACAM Associates, exceptional management, impeccable reputation for New York co-ops, condos, and condops since 1983. Learn more at ACAM.com.
Now we're back with another archive segment, a major story on our show a year ago. I'm Catherine Herzog.
I'm David Alpern. This week last year, we joined a media throng covering the royal distraction of Britain's Prince William marrying commoner Kate Middleton from our May 1st, 2011 broadcast hosted by Eddie Robinson and me.
William Arthur Philip Louis.
Take thee, Catherine Elizabeth.
Take thee, Catherine Elizabeth.
Aye, Catherine Elizabeth.
Take thee, William Arthur Philip Louis.
Take thee, William Arthur Philip Louis.
Britannia ruled the waves again last week thanks to the royal wedding of Prince William and commoner Kate Middleton. At least the airwaves and webwaves, at least for as many as 3 billion viewers not otherwise occupied fighting terrorists in Afghanistan and Iraq or not fighting for and against democracy in Syria, Libya, other Mideast hotspots, or not struggling to survive disasters, both natural and man-made, from quake, tsunami, and nuclear-crippled Japan to tornado-devastated areas of the United States to economic hard times in Britain itself.
For those who cared, the tsunami of video carried all the best details. That no longer secret Sarah Burton wedding dress, the royal pair's sly smiles, and Will's brief struggle to slip the ring on Kate's finger in Westminster Abbey. The open carriage ride back to Buckingham Palace, and not one but two kisses on the balcony there. Then the young marrieds driving off in Dad's old sports car, a just wed plate on the back with a number 5 for the S, as if they couldn't arrange the real thing, and a nice L for learners on the front, despite the fact that they've been a couple for years.
But for the 1.5 million actually assembled in the streets of London, the magic was less about seeing than being there. So reported Boston Globe staff writer Billy Baker, and for your ears only, he joins us now for some special sidelights of the royal wedding. Welcome to our program.
Thank you for having me.
You found more wedding mania among Americans there than among the Brits. What kind of explanations did the visitors give?
We were here for a week, and at the beginning of the week, we spent a lot of time talking to the Brits about the buildup, and they seemed to point to us, you know, flip it on us and say, you know, it's you Yanks that are really into this, but I think by wedding day, you know, the million-plus people that were there, there were no nationalities. Everyone was pretty keyed up and excited, and it was quite an event.
Another factor seemed to be a certain public familiarity with Will and Kate from the years they lived almost normal lives among their future subjects.
Yeah, you know, I mean, a friend of mine, an American who lives in London, would put it this way, like, you know, we see them at, you know, our favorite restaurants, we see them about town. It is that sort of familiarity, and, you know, the saying is familiarity breeds contempt. In some cases, that seemed to be what we're hearing from people. Others were unabashed in their excitement, and then there was sort of the middle ground, the lukewarm, you know, we'll take the bank holiday, we'll watch it in the pub, it'll be fun to celebrate because everyone loves a wedding. You know, endorsements were, I won't say few and far between, but as the week went on, it seemed like it was hard not to get swept up in both this fairy tale and the British ability to deliver pomp and circumstance like none other.
For much of the time before and during the ceremony, you were surprised by the civility outside, the benevolent bobbies, your ability to move around. And at one point, though, you found yourself being, you know, used as a tripod. Tell us about that.
It was, I mean, the British people have been wonderful this week. The police, I mean, this was a logistical nightmare. There were just so many people, and rather than get a little cold and distant, it was, you know, you'd ask for directions, and they would welcome you as a friend, and come wedding week, there would be instances where I'd be standing somewhere, and I couldn't believe that I'm in the middle of the street at Westminster Abbey, and they're not chasing me off the road right away. There was even a very cute moment in the morning of the wedding. You know, the crowds are there. We're waiting for Kate Middleton to make her way from the hotel to Westminster Abbey. And someone just let their dogs run free around the rotary, the statue in front of Buckingham Palace. And rather than panic, the police just sat there and watched these two dogs play and entertain the crowd. And it was really sort of a sweet, laid-back, calm moment for this police force and this country. It really went well.
Talk about the sleeping bag races in St. James Park.
Yeah, well, you have to understand, I don't know how many people actually camped out, but it was, you know, in the tens of thousands. And by the time, you know, the sun rose behind Big Ben, some were loopy, some were drunk. there was a sort of a general, you know, I don't know how many actually got sleep, but you had a lot of young people who were, yeah, doing things like, you know, having potato sack races in their sleeping bags. You saw all sorts of men and women in wedding dresses, but strangely, mostly men, you know, William and Kate masks and outfits and the camping setups. I thought I would feel bad for the people camping out because it was supposed to rain. It ultimately didn't, but the setups were really just fantastic. I mean, you know, they had the ability to make a pot of tea. They were drinking champagne. They were sharing with each other. It was really sort of a gregarious shared experience.
You did a lot of tweeting about the wedding day and what you called your embracing the ridiculousness. What would you say were your best 140 characters on the episode?
My thumbs are a bit sore. It was sort of the perfect venue to use Twitter as a form of journalism. With the time change and things like that, the morning newspaper, it was certainly already old news by the time things came out, but the ability to just sort of transmit immediately, it was wonderful. And, you know, it was just more like see it, write it down, send it out to our readers. And it really got a wonderful response. I haven't been a Twitter convert until now. I've been saying I'm going to retire. But you know what? It was there was one that seemed to be quite popular, which was in midweek where I just saw a guy wearing a Prince William face mask. And I took his photo in front of Buckingham Palace. And then I wrote that he smelled of lager. Yeah, it was symbolic for me of the entire week. That was a sort of scene you saw, happiness, celebration, a bit of tongue-in-cheek mocking of this whole royal idea, but ultimately hard not to be won over.
And you got some good responses from your followers, like the fireman back in Boston with a warning for Wills?
Yeah, he suggested he get in his helicopter and chop her out of this whole thing because it's a bad idea. But, there were just moments there where it would be, you know, we spent a lot of time down on the Mall at Buckingham Palace, Westminster Abbey, on the parade route, interacting with people. And you would just forget that inside one of these large stone buildings were a young man and a young woman about to get married. I know, in the build-up to my own wedding, you know, you're just dealing with so much chaos, and you have these small moments where you realize what you're actually about to do. And I would wonder if you know, William were in there, thinking about it, having second thoughts, who knows?
What among the sea of wedding souvenirs did you find most tempting, the Wills and Kate barf bag?
I didn't actually see those. I know those were quite popular. A lot of people writing about them. We did see Will and Kate condoms. They said there was a cartoon of the two, and it said, and they live happily ever after, something like that. You know, you had your sort of what I would describe as sort of your traditional kitschy English souvenirs, the plates, the bells, the spoons, that sort of thing. But, you know, it was... there were lots of places you could buy things, but there weren't lots of things to buy. I was actually quite surprised that it wasn't as obnoxious as it certainly could have been. But, you know, it was all done in good taste, and it seemed to just be, there's sort of that one, I think it's the official photo of Will and Kate, and that just seemed to be on everything. It wasn't over the top, but last night, the Globe photographer, I'm with Dina Rudick, and I went out about 2 a.m. because our time is just way off, and walking around, and we stumbled upon a souvenir stand that was just filled with Americans buying everything on the shelves. So, at 2 a.m. on the wedding day, people were still going strong, still consuming this this fairy tale, this spectacle, whatever it was, whatever it is. Lots of people like it, and lots of people consumed it.
Reporter Billy Baker covered the royal wedding for the Boston Globe.
Royal distraction from our May 1st, 2011 broadcast. In the years since, Kate has developed an easygoing royal air and a close relationship with the royal family, reportedly enjoying low-profile outings to art galleries and the opera with her father-in-law, the Prince of Wales, even showing him how to use a hot iron, apparently for the first time ever, to press designs on silk. Kate's sister Pippa, who some thought stole some wedding day spotlight, earlier in April faced possible questioning by police when pictures emerged of her driving with a friend while he brandished what seemed to be a real pistol. She also attended a Louis XIV Marie Antoinette costume evening with three dwarves serving canapés and champagne. I'm Catherine Herzog. We'll visit the archive again next week.
And I'm David Alpern, now with actress-dancer Jane Powell singing my favorite song from the 1951 MGM Fred Astaire musical, Royal Wedding.